Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. There's lots of great music going on in the Triad this month, and the sound of opera, staged plays, and Celtic music will be ringing in the air for the next 2 weeks, beginning with Robert Ward's powerful Pulitzer Prize-winning opera, The Crucible. He's here to talk about it with Piedmont Opera Executive Director Frank Dickerson. Then, for UNCSA Chancellor John Maucheri, the music of Eric Wolfgang Korngold is personal. For decades, he's championed the music of American composers who fled the Nazi regime, and he's bringing an American premiere to the Agnes DeMille Theater. And we wrap things up today with an Irish jig and a cold Guinness beer. Bryn Mawr is coming up next on Triad Arts Weekend. Of the many famous American novels and plays that have been converted into operas, my guest today tops the list, American composer and Durham, North Carolina resident Robert Ward. The 94-year-old composer and educator has written 8 operas, and in 1962, The Crucible, based on the renowned play of the same name by Arthur Miller, won the Pulitzer Prize and the New York Music Critics Circle Citation. The Crucible weaves a tale of lust, pride, revenge, and power against a backdrop of the Salem witch trials of the late 17th century. Miller's powerful play was written as an allegory for 1950s McCarthyism, of which he himself was a victim. It remains extremely relevant today, and it's coming to the Triad courtesy of Piedmont Opera in collaboration with the A.J. Fletcher Opera Institute of the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. Their production runs Friday, March 16th through the 20th at the Stevens Center in Winston-Salem. You'll find links to ticket information, concert times, and more at wfdd.org/triadarts. Last year, Robert Ward was the recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts Opera Honors. He was presented the award by current UNCSA Chancellor John Maucheri. Robert Ward himself was the chancellor of the then North Carolina School of the Arts from 1967 until 1975. He dropped by WFDD last week to talk with me. Here's part two of our conversation. He essentially handpicked you to write the music to this, to write the
album. Well, what happened, I handpicked to write it because I had gotten to the play for that time, and I was just bowled over by it. And so it was a question of how do I get to him directly. I was able to do that. So he was very interested, and he then was able to see my first opera. It was done at New York City Opera, and that really turned things over.
That sealed the deal.
Yeah.
Your association with librettist Bernard Stabler goes back a ways to the Juilliard days.
That's right.
What was the back and forth like between you and him during the process of writing this work?
Well, in the first place, Bernie, when he was in high school, he was in the claque at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. So he knew more opera than I knew. So when I learned about him and approached him with the possibility of working together, he was very excited about it. So right from the start, we worked very closely, and he had a family about the same size as mine. We became very good friends as well. He had all this knowledge of it, and I had the kind of musical abilities which I thought would work with opera because I had sung in operettas in high school and so forth.
In terms of the back and forth then between you all and Arthur Miller, was there any, what sort of feedback were you getting along the way?
Well, before we got the rights, after we had explained what we wanted and so forth, he had seen, of course, our first opera, so he knew the kind of music I wrote. And then he said, do you suppose you could write a couple scenes that I could get some impression of the modern music you'd write for this? So I said, fine. Wrote 2 scenes and got a soprano that I knew well, and myself singing the baritone role, and we sang them for him. And he said, that's it. And he called his agent immediately and said, get a contract signed here.
What did that feel like?
Yeah, that felt very good.
I can imagine.
And then Julius Rudell, who was head of the New York City Opera at that time, he was very interested because they were doing a whole series of American operas. So he set the time when he'd like to do it in about 10 months away. Well, that's a very short time to write an opera for anybody almost, except maybe Verdi. And, but we were so excited, we said, we'll do our best.
Rebecca, how good of you to come.
The Crucible set against the backdrop of 17th century Salem witch trials, but the play is really an allegory to the McCarthyism and the House Un-American activities. Arthur Miller fell victim to this, to McCarthyism. What did he share with you about that time in his life?
Well, the way it all happened, McCarthy was calling in all these people from Hollywood and so forth, and his questioning, a very important part, was, who did you meet with in all this time? And they would spell out all these names. Well, then when Aaron went to testify...
Are you talking about Aaron Copland, or you're talking about Arthur Miller?
Arthur Miller.
Because Aaron was also called
Aaron
in front of the group.
Aaron was called, too.
Yeah.
And he said right off, he said, look, I'll tell you anything about my own association, but I will not answer any questions about the other. Well, McCarthy was furious. That's the way it all got started.
I should throw this your way, Frank. What goes into a production, feet on the ground making it happen, and speak to some of the grants going on to make it happen?
We started working on this over 3 years ago, actually. The first thing, you know, Jamie had been thinking about even before I joined the opera as executive director.
Jamie Albritton.
Yeah, Jamie Albritton, our artistic director. And actually the first thing I did as the executive director of the Piedmont Opera was write the grant request to the National Endowment for the Arts. And that was our first grant. We needed to get that to get us, you know, off the ground and create some momentum and create some credibility. Mm-hmm. But we needed to raise a fair amount of money to do this because this opera and the events we wanted to do around it were about 50% more than we would normally spend on an opera. But from there, we were able to get money from Opera America, the National Association for Professional Opera Companies all over the country. We were able to get money from the Mary Duke Biddle Foundation in Durham. We got $12,000 from the NEA, $10,000 from Opera America, another $5,000 from Mary Duke Biddle, $15,000 out of the Kapnick Foundation in Chicago, which came through a relationship I had, but we had to convince them that this was a project worth supporting, and then $5,000 from the Haynes Foundation here in Winston. So the $47,000 we got in grant money, only $5,000 came from the Triad. Only $10,000 of it came from North Carolina. And then we turned, with that sort of base, again, of credibility, we turned to corporate sponsors and raised, about $60,000 of corporate sponsorship for this, including Haynes Brands, who is the Crucible Experience sponsor. Because the pitch we made is we wanted to create a conversation about the theme of this opera, as well as to do the opera, a conversation about McCarthyism and what it says to us today. So among other things, we created a study guide for the Forsyth County school system for 11th graders, and they are doing a combined unit in American history, American literature, and music and art around the Crucible. Two of the schools actually did the play in the fall, and we also created all the events that we've done.
Boy, it sounds like a great program, and there's so many opportunities to learn. I want to steer it your way, Dr. Ward, in terms of this, you know, New York City Opera, which you referenced, big problems financially, Greensboro Opera going through some tough times. What suggestions, what advice do you have for regional opera organizations moving forward in terms of sustaining this art?
Well, there are lots of things in this. For instance, there are the big operas like the Aidas, and the Crucible is a big one. It takes a big cast, big sets, and so forth. And those become very expensive. But there are a number of operas which, for instance, take only seven or eight people and a smaller orchestra, one scene rather than a whole bunch. So, one, the companies have to fall back on those. Even the Metropolitan has to cut back. So, that's one thing. The other thing is that I think the opera people in America have made a great mistake in not considering Broadway musicals as good entertainment as the Strauss musicals. And some of them are now realizing that, because to me the great Broadway musicals are tremendous and can draw huge audiences. They should be brought into the whole program.
You've also talked about sharing productions.
Yes, I have indeed. And that's harder to get through because a lot of these people feel, oh, that's my opera company. And they really need to take this step of doing a fine production and then take it to 4 or 5, if possible, other cities in the state. This would cut their budgets in half.
By sharing costs, essentially.
Yes.
Dr. Ward had said about cooperating with other opera companies. And as you mentioned, the Greensboro Opera has had some difficulties. And we're trying to reach out to them and find ways that we can work together with them as we move forward. Because, well, in some ways it probably makes sense for the Triad to have one opera company, and maybe that's the ultimate goal. But even short of that, there should be ways that we can cooperate with each other and find ways to share cost and other things so we can provide more great opera for the Triad at a cheaper cost.
Part 2 of my interview with renowned American composer and educator Dr. Robert Ward. The Piedmont Opera, in collaboration with the A.J. Fletcher Opera Institute of the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, will present their production of Robert Ward's The Crucible, Friday, March 16th through the 20th, at the Stevens Center in Winston-Salem. On Saturday morning at 11 o'clock, it'll be a conversation with the composer at the Stevens Center, with Dr. Ward sharing his thoughts in person on his Pulitzer Prize-winning opera. You'll find links to ticket information and more on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend on 88.5 WFDD. I'm David Ford. Austrian composer Erich Wolfgang Korngold is best known today as one of the founders of film music. In 1938, The Adventures of Robin Hood was the first movie in which the composer, Korngold, and not the studio music department head, was awarded the Oscar. But when Korngold fled the Nazi regime and remained in the U.S., he brought with him a wealth of first-hand experiences, having absorbed the European musical traditions of composers like Gustav Mahler, Richard Strauss, as well as the great staged play genre, popular in Europe from the 18th century to around 1925. From that tradition comes the first fully integrated production of Much Ado About Nothing by William Shakespeare, with music by Korngold, since the music was outlawed by the Nazis in 1933. Korngold champion and University of North Carolina School of the Arts Chancellor John Maucheri will conduct the American premiere, performed by members of UNCSA's Schools of Drama and Music, March 29th through April 7th, with evening performances at 8 and weekend matinees at 2 in the Agnes DeMille Theater on the UNCSA campus in Winston-Salem. Last week, John spoke with me by phone from New York. Here's part 2 of our conversation.
In surviving World War II, in surviving the fact that he had to leave one part of the world and live in an entirely different part of the world and survive with a wife, a mama, and a papa, and 2 children, he wrote for Warner Brothers. And he didn't write any differently, by the way, for Warner Brothers than he'd been writing for the Vienna State Opera. He called his film scores Operas Without Singers. And, I mean, I think we can look at the 2 great Viennese masters, Arnold Schoenberg and Erich Korngold, and see 2 men who had to survive. And Schoenberg survived by teaching in the university system of California, UCLA and USC. And his contemporary, who had a different style, but basically grew up at the same time, survived by writing film scores for Warner Brothers.
What was that transition like for Korngold? I mean, Korngold obviously had to flee.
It's more a crossfade than that. He was invited to Los Angeles in the mid-1930s. Now, a lot of people don't make the differentiation between Austrians and Germans. Hitler came to power in 1933, but the annexation of Austria to the Nazi Third Reich did not happen until 1938. So while borders were closing and the Jewish community in Germany were fleeing, the Austrians were unsure that this would happen to them. And, you know, there's never the day that, you know, everybody out by Thursday kind of thing. It's you're starting to watch stuff and there are rumors and everything. So while this transition is happening, starting 1933, of course, where Hitler seizes power, Korngold was invited to Los Angeles in, I guess, 1934 or 1935, because Max Reinhardt, the great Jewish theater director with whom Korngold had worked, Max Reinhardt was asked by Warner Brothers to make a high-budget film version of all things, A Midsummer Night's Dream. using Mendelssohn's music. And Reinhardt said, I could never adapt all this music. You can only do this with Erich Wolfgang Korngold, because he could adapt the Mendelssohn for film. So Korngold went to Los Angeles in those days with his family and loved the medium of sound film because he completely got it. He had the kind of brain where he could figure out exactly how many feet of film at what tempo would require how many bars of music. He could just do that in his head. So he really enjoyed it. And while he was out there, the Warner Brothers people were so thrilled to have this great and famous composer on their staff that he started writing. And he would go in the winter. He would leave Vienna with his younger son and his wife, because his younger son had asthma, and it was a great boon for them to have the warm air and the sunshine for their son. And so during that period, Korngold was going back and forth. But in 1938, when he was in Los Angeles to look at the dailies of The Adventures of Robin Hood, which was the Technicolor movie that Warner Brothers was making with Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland and Basil Rathbone, that was when he had a kind of breakdown because he realized he couldn't write this music. He felt it wasn't like him and it was too much of a cartoon and it was got too many fight scenes in it. So he went back, he wrote a letter to Warner Brothers saying, I'm really sorry, please don't hate me, but this is not a project I can do and I'm going back to Vienna. That's when his wife was on the phone with Eric's parents saying that the Anschluss was going to happen and that they couldn't ever go home. But they couldn't go home, at least while this situation existed. And they had to smuggle Korngold's parents out and the older son who was in high school out of Vienna, because if they went back, they would never be allowed out. So the big panic there was to get Korngold's parents and Ernst, who was in high school, out. And Ernst, whom I knew, told me that the three of them, because Ernst had a passport that would allow him to travel with his grandparents, they left on the last train out of Vienna before the borders were closed, and he sat on a Nazi soldier's lap. And so the entire family then was located in Los Angeles at Toluca Lake. And years later, Korngold said with not an ounce of irony that it was Robin Hood who saved his family's life. Because he was an optimistic person, he thought he could go back to Vienna after the war and bygones would be bygones, and it turned out that that was not the case and that the Viennese were terrible to him and the reviews were devastating, and it really broke his heart. He attempted to rebuild the past in that sense, and it was no longer there because, after all, they lost the war. And there was tremendous rage. I mean, it's almost inconceivable for us to think about. I mean, you know, we think of Germany and Austria, and we know about the war, and we know about the Nazis, and we love the music of Beethoven and Wagner and Strauss and Mahler, and we kind of don't think about the people who were running the institutions and what they had to go through when they literally lost the war, and how they reacted to the composers who had become Americans.
Hmm.
I mean, Erich Korngold was an American citizen, and Schoenberg, and Stravinsky was living in Hollywood, and Hindemith was teaching at Yale, and, you know, and that's just musicians, and Kurt Weill was having success on Broadway. And how do you deal with all of those so-called American works by their greatest composers? And they did not deal well with them. They dismissed all of them. They did not play them. If they did play them, they wrote bad reviews about them. And they gave different excuses for why you shouldn't play the American symphonies by Hindemith or any of the music by Korngold or anything that Kurt Weill wrote when he wasn't working with Bertolt Brecht in Berlin. And it's only, you know, 65 years later that through the work of a number of us, and it's not just me, but a lot of conductors who are actually saying, this is just unfair. These men wrote great music in our country as well as in Europe. The man who runs the Konzerthaus, the big concert hall in Vienna, once referred to this music. He said, John, this is inconvenient music. It's a perfect use of the word. It's inconvenient because Austrians and Germans have to accept the fact that they would have killed their greatest composers of the time. And so they escaped, most of them escaped, and they survived. They more than survived. They wrote great music. Now, to accept this great music that was written in Los Angeles or New Haven or Broadway was really tough. And it still is tough. So we're now two generations later, and most of your listeners have never heard of the name of Erich Wolfgang Korngold. And yet, see, the good part of this story is that hundreds of millions of people have heard his music, even if they don't know his name. And they know his music because of the movies that he wrote for and the great orchestra at Warner Brothers that played it. And because his music is the model for much of the great epic scores that are still being written in Hollywood. His music created the tradition that is the tradition of John Williams and of Howard Shore and those people who are writing the big orchestral scores today. Star Wars, for example, where the swashbuckling sound of those epic movies that Korngold scored became the model of what George Lucas and Steven Spielberg wanted for their basically science fiction cartoon called Star Wars. They wanted a big orchestra to accompany it. That became something that in the 1970s, you know, in fact, some of Korngold's music was used as the temporary soundtrack for that film, and then John was asked to write in that style, which he knew very well because John was playing celesta and keyboards in Los Angeles in the 1950s when all of those great composers are still alive.
I love it. Oh, that's good. So you get the Robin Hood theme comes back into Star Wars in some incarnation.
Yeah, and the Robin Hood theme goes back to Sursum Corda, which was the big orchestral tone poem that Korngold wrote when he was writing Much Ado About Nothing.
Part two of my conversation with University of North Carolina School of the Arts Chancellor John Mocheri. He'll conduct the first fully integrated production of Much Ado About Nothing by William Shakespeare with music by Erich Korngold since the music was outlawed by the Nazis in 1933. The American premiere by members of UNCSA's Schools of Drama and Music will be March 29th through April 7th with evening performances at 8 and weekend matinees at 2 in the Agnes DeMille Theater on the UNCSA campus in Winston-Salem. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadart. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend on 88.5 WFDD. I'm David Ford. Bryn Mawr is coming up next after the break. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Looking for a truly authentic way to celebrate St. Patrick's Day this year? Well, thanks to the new band Bryn Mawr and Encore American Bistro, you don't have to book a flight to Dublin to enjoy an incredible evening of Irish dancing, live Celtic music, and a cold Guinness beer. The St. Paddy's Party kicks off at 9 o'clock March 17th at the Bistro on 4th Street in Winston-Salem, and you can dance and sing along till midnight with the exciting Celtic rock sounds of Bryn Mawr live in concert. Today I'll be speaking with three members of the band, and we'll be sampling from their recordings throughout the show. Singer-guitarist Robert Gabb, fiddler Rex McGee, and Sharon Fogarty, who plays flutes and whistles, drop by WFDD to talk about it.
I put the band together after wanting to get back into my Celtic music again, and then it was just finding the right musicians.
So your early beginnings of your association with Celtic music, where did it begin for you, Robert?
In Wales.
In Wales?
Yes.
Hearing
mm-hmm.
it at home, hearing it in pubs, where did you grow up with it?
At home and pubs. I grew up with musicians, so my mother was a musician, all my uncles are musicians.
What's it like carrying on that tradition? And what do you,
oh, mean, it's great. I mean, it's just a whip on a different flair to it, you know. I mean, and a lot of people are doing that now.
Yeah.
You know, the Pogues started doing it back in the 80s, you know, putting a little bit of rock and roll onto it, and it slowly progressed. You know, there's a lot of big bands doing it now.
Yeah, it's a nice mix. I'm mm-hmm. thinking of Caper Cayley. That's one of my favorites from back in the day, where mm-hmm. they just had that mix of the old and the new. Why does it work so well? Rex, you want to take a stab at that one? It's funky, in the best sense of the word. It's just cool.
It boils down to a lot of these tunes are dance tunes that go back to reels and jigs and those sort of things. It's not too hard to put what might be considered a more of a modern rock drum beat to those sort of types of rhythms. They're still danceable.
I love the mix of sounds I'm hearing, too, because in this track we just heard Comfy Down, you get that great low end and the drums, and then there you are, Sharon, just tearing it up top. It's a nice shimmery sounds. Is it fun playing in that? And that's different. That's a kind of a departure for you in terms of that style of music. How's it been?
Oh, yeah. It's completely different. This group plays a lot more reels and then a lot of upbeat stuff. And, you know, I grew up with rock. I was classically trained. I have a lot of Irish dancers in my family, so this is perfect blend for me. This it speaks to me in all aspects.
I want to get back to Wales and you're growing up. When were you hearing this music? Set the scene for typical people are breaking out instruments and you're...
Right across the road from my mother's house, there was a pub called the Royal Oak. And then every Friday night there, we'd break out a drum kit, an organ, maybe a guitar player and a bass player. And then everybody just go up and sign up. You know, you just write down what song you wanted to play, you know, what song you wanted to sing. So that went on all night long. And then they'd lock the doors and then the fun would begin, you know. This man right here, he lays it down. He really does. And it's been so hard to find somebody that can, you know, get that Irish groove and that true Irish feel. And Rex certainly got it. He's a musician's musician.
Talk me through that tune, Rex. We just got finished here in County Down. How do you grab a hold of it and make it your own?
I come from a more old-time, you know, North Carolina fiddling tradition. And so for me, it was just taking a tune that I already knew and changing the rhythm up on it. And the style becomes a little bit more of an improvising rock and roll, jam out, shred fiddle type approach to it.
The show's going to start at 9 and go on till midnight. We're going to have hopefully some good Irish dancers there. A lot of Guinness.
I was going to ask you about that Guinness. That's a crucial, you know, makes the band sound better.
They go hand in hand, you know. They really do.
Yeah, and we're hoping, we definitely encourage anybody, any kind of dancing, to come on and join in. This is going to be your typical night scene, as if you were celebrating St. Patrick's Day in Ireland. And the instruments come out and everybody can just enjoy themselves.
My thanks to singer-guitarist Robert Gabb, fiddler Rex McGee, and Sharon Fogarty, who plays flutes and whistles. They're one half of the Celtic band Bryn Mawr, and they'll be at Encore American Bistro on 4th Street in Winston-Salem. When else? This St. Patrick's Day, March 17th from 9 o'clock to midnight, and you're invited. That's all for today's show. You can hear my complete interviews with Robert Ward and John Maucheri on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.